in that beginning. We might have to do that again. We'll have to do a repeat of that maybe on Thursday. We'll have a little dance session there that we'll record and we'll put in. Okay, so like I said, it is now Tuesday, 12:46 on January 26th. This is our first class meeting. I always like to do a little introduction when I start the recording. And let's start just with sort of an overview of what I expect the class to look like, where you can find information, where things are located, give you an overview of all of that. We'll get into some content today, but I might spend the bulk of today just sort of orienting you guys in terms of where we're at and introducing me, because you haven't had a chance to meet me before. Okay, so first off, I hate Canvas and I am a Canvas idiot. Canvas and I do not get along well. I'm getting better. We're sort of frenemies at this point. And so the Canvas shell is turned on, but I haven't uploaded any of the modules other than the introductory module that has all the course information and sort of the syllabus broken out in different areas. What I have used forever is my own course website and to manage the course. And so I'm going to kind of show you where that is and work off of that rather than working off the Canvas shell right now, because that's more complete and easier to find everything. So let me show you where that is. And let me start a screen share. Go back to basics. And I'll just take up a window. We'll take window 2. And along with that, I'm going to bring in a new okay. And I'll get the chat out of there. All right, and if there's any questions, when I start moving around windows and start doing this, I lose track of everybody's faces. Let's see if I can bring everybody back. There we go. I try to track the chat and faces at the same time. And I don't have any requirements in terms of keeping your cameras on or off. I understand that people are working from home and in different situations and in work situations sometimes, and sometimes it's not appropriate to have your camera on. So I completely understand that. If at any point you have a question or want to break in, feel free. I like to have discussions more than I like a monotone. It's not just about what I have to say. I want to make sure that I get your questions addressed, and those are really important to me. So feel free to communicate to me in any way you feel comfortable, whether it be putting it into the chat, whether it be unmuting your microphone using the space bar, or throwing a raised hand icon up there in terms of feedback, and I will try to get to you as fast as I can. My screen is going to be a little bit limited. I think I can see one of our screens. We're up to 2 screens now. But I'll do my best. So maybe the chat might be the best way if you have a question, or unmuting your mic. Feel free to unmute at any time. Okay, so what I want to do is take you to chemed.study. So this is, I'll throw it into the chat, chemed.study, which is my personal website. And Cabrillo took all of the professor's websites, and in the migration to the new Cabrillo website, which is painful, let's be honest, if you were used to the old website, the new website is not, it seems not new, it seems hard. They got rid of all the instructor websites. So the instructors needed to move all of their websites off Cabrillo, and for accessibility reasons, they were concerned about having all of that instructor information, and everything that is at the Cabrillo website needs to be 100% accessible to all individuals with all different sorts of physical disabilities or learning disabilities. It all needs to be accessible, which this site mostly is that I've got put together. So here at chemed.study, I've got my contact information. I've got my office hours that are up there that you can find. I've got what I'm currently teaching, what I'm scheduled to teach. There's links here that will take you back to the Cabrillo website. So if you want to go back to the Cabrillo home website or things, those links will all take you there. And then the course web pages. And for us, that's the 12B and the 12BL. And they're on the same web page. So Chem 12B and BL, the lab, while it is a separate course and then you get a separate grade for it, I've thrown all the content onto lecture resources and laboratory resources and all into the same place. And I've got my rubrics that I use. for assessing different types of assignments, the syllabus, the schedule, the cooperative assignments that I know Zaruba uses cooperatives as well, I think. So, or he uses, I think he uses that name for sort of challenge assignments. I've got some additional resources that are up. I've got all of my lectures from last fall because those students wanted me to retain those online. And so they're still accessing those and going back and reviewing things as they want to. And then I've got a home for where our new lectures are going to go. And so just starting off with that syllabus, and I think I'll work from the PDF. The syllabus has, again, the virtual Zoom hours. It has my email on there, jason.camera@cabrillo.edu. There are two email addresses, jason.camera@cabrillo.edu or jacamera@cabrillo.edu. If you go online, you may see it as jacamera@cabrillo.edu on the Cabrillo website. They are the same web address. They do not go to different locations. One is an alias for the other. So no matter which of those two you send an email address or send an email to, it will get to me in my inbox in the same inbox. So don't worry about which one you use, just to make it easy. Our lecture is Tuesday, Thursday, 12:40 to 2. That is when I will do live lectures. And the lectures are not mandatory, but highly encouraged. I find that learning is done best when you can ask questions and when we can have a dialogue. And I've had some classes that I taught last semester, I taught a Chem 30A lab where I had one student who showed up for most of the time. And sometimes I didn't have any students despite the live lectures that I was giving. And so sometimes I was just recording the live lecture to record it. And those, to be honest with you, are crummy lectures. Those are some of the worst lectures I've ever given because I'm just talking to myself and it's whatever I feel like I want to talk about. I highly value your questions in taking the discussion where it needs to go so that I can effectively teach. And I can't teach unless I know what concerns and issues you guys have. So that's my pitch to you in terms of showing up and being here if you can. All right. I will always answer your questions and I will almost always thank you for your questions. And sometimes I'll bang my head on the table like, oh, they asked that one. That is the hardest one to explain, but that just means you're making me work and that's good. That's what I need to do. So, finals week is the week of May 17th. And this goes to, for a moment, about how I plan to do assignments. Because the class is asynchronous, you will have windows of time to complete the assignments. When I put up a quiz, you'll probably have a couple of days to do the quiz, if not over the weekend. When I give a test, same sort of thing, you'll have over the weekend to do the exam. It is not a timed exercise, so that while we are in session, when we're having in-person classes, normally we have a finite amount of time. We have like an hour and a half to go through and do an exam. And I know that some teachers are holding to that. And in the Canvas shell, they're programming it so that you have an hour and a half to do the exam within the Canvas shell. Last semester, I just opened it up and found not a whole lot of difference between the grades of having it as a timed exercise, hour and a half, versus having it opened up. So I give a whole window of opportunity and you'll have more than 24 hours to be able to complete an assignment, such as an exam or a quiz. So you don't need to worry about that. If you find that something in your life comes up, I know that some people may be facing evacuations right now and may not be in their home location, given what's going on with the weather and the atmospheric river that is projected to hit us starting any time now, that in the Boulder Creek area, they've done some fairly extensive evacuations. So I hope you're not in that category. But if something were to come up during the semester and you were facing an exam or a quiz, just shoot me an email and let me know what's going on and we'll extend those deadlines for you and make it accessible. So don't worry about that. Okay. Materials wise, our textbook, Klein, is a fantastic textbook. You've already been using it. So this is the same materials that Zaruba used. There's nothing here that I'm requiring that Zaruba hasn't already required of you. So you shouldn't have to acquire any new materials in order to take the second semester class. Just in case there's anybody new who's sitting in here, and I know I have one student who just enrolled who did not take 12A with Zaruba. So there might be others too. I don't know for sure. So it's worth just mentioning these things. The Klein textbook can be obtained as a as an electronic. In fact, let me go back here for a second. Under the syllabus on the HTML, I have a little tab here that says textbook options. And it has all the different prices and places where you can buy those textbooks and different options. Sometimes I suggest that maybe the most current textbook is not always the best textbook because of its expense, and you can get it cheaper by going to an older version, which works just as well because they change very little in that textbook as they go from version 1 to version 2 to version 3. So, but that's a little bit harder to read. So I'm gonna stick in the PDF. So that's there. The study guide, I recommend the study guide because I don't know exactly how Zaruba does things. I know that students have asked me if I'm gonna be posting problem sets online, and I will post some, but mainly the way that I have always worked is to have you guys work problems in the textbook and not have me assign a subset to say these are really good, because in the textbook, they're all good. And because they're all good, as much practice as you can get is what you want. And so you work through the textbook problems and you work through them all. And the solution manual is an aid in doing that. I wouldn't go to the solutions manual right away. I tend to think that struggling with a problem for a little bit is a good exercise. Learning to sit with a problem for more than 10 minutes before going to a solutions guide or a solution set, if it's a problem set that I put online, at least 10 minutes. Learning to lengthen that time and struggle with a problem longer is an important skill set, because really in industry and in academia, we struggle with problems that take years to solve. And sometimes we're working on a problem that we don't have a solution that we may work with for months or years before we resolve that. That's not uncommon within chemistry and physics and engineering and things. So learning to struggle with a problem, struggle is learning. It's good. It's important. Klein also wrote a book called OChem as a Second Language, First Semester Topics. There's a second semester topics book too. It's not as good as the first. The first takes you up through, I believe, spectroscopy. And then after spectroscopy, it moves on to the second semester topics. The second semester book is okay. It's just not as good a practice and as detailed and as accessible as the first semester book. So if you're thinking about that, Klein OChem as a Second Language, for the first couple of weeks here, that first semester one that you may already have is a great resource for problems. The second semester one, if you have money to throw at it, not a bad idea, but I wouldn't go out and say this is something that you need to have. And then the molecular modeling kit, we use periodically, particularly as we get through stereochemistry, which you've already gone through to a degree. Second semester, we tend not to use that modeling kit quite as much as we might use it first semester. And you're also familiar with WebMO and the ability to model things online in 3D, which kind of alleviates the need and supplants that whole model kit set. This is a good question. I didn't ask Zaruba. You all have, I expect, WebMO accounts. And Zaruba, starting Chem 12A, is going to want to load in his new students. I'm going to see if there isn't a way that I can archive your accounts and keep them active and switch them over into Chem 12B so that Zaruba can't delete them. And that'll keep all your files as well. So that's a good note for me to do. Make a note of that. Now I'll remember. Okay.
About the textbook.
Yeah.
Is that study manual that you have, is that just the all of the questions that are in the back of the book, but all put together with the solution manual, or is it different questions than the questions that are in each section?
Yeah, the solutions manual. So what happens is within most textbooks, they have like the odd numbered answers in the back of the textbook. The solutions manual answers all of the questions, not just the odd, and it does them in a more detailed way. So it has greater explanations for most of the answers to the questions.
Okay, and the student study guide part, is it broken up like questions and then answers, or is it just the question, answer? Not that it matters.
So. Yeah, I don't, you know, it's been a long time since I've looked at it. And in fact, I don't even think I have it here. I don't. Yeah, I'd have to grab it and look at it. I don't know. Good question.
It's all right.
Sorry.
I had a question as well. So is that all in one? The study guide and solutions manual is one product?
It is. It's one product.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. And there are bundles that you can get where you can get the textbook and that study guide all together. So that's an option as well. Okay. Student learner outcomes. They are not that different from Chem 12A. The only thing that's really different here is that we extend into different functional groups. We do a functional group approach, essentially. And so in Chem 12B, you guys have gotten up to alkynes in 12A. We're going to pick up with alkynes. We'll go into, down here someplace. There's a schedule. We'll go into radical reactions and talk about free radical reactions. We'll then do a small section on synthesis that relates to both the alkynes and the radicals and the SN1, SN2, SN1, E2 reactions that you covered previously and how to put them all together and start using them in synthesis. We'll extend that in looking at alcohols and phenols and then to ethers, epoxides, thiols, and sulfides. We take a break after chapter 14 and we hit mass spectrometry and NMR, magnetic nuclear magnetic resonance. And we do what's called a spectroscopy chapter where we figure out what molecules look like. How do we know what these molecules look like? That's something that we haven't talked to date yet. So we've talked all about these molecules and nobody has ever asked, well, how do you know what that looks like? How do you know what that molecule is? You can't see that molecule. How do you know what the structure is? And if you have a brand new molecule and you've never seen it before, how do you figure out what its structure is? That's what this chapter is about. That's what all of this IR, mass spec, NMR, that's what we do in there. And then we jump back out of that. We jump into conjugated pi systems and paracyclic reactions, getting us ready for things like aromatic compounds. And then we start doing the reactions of aromatic compounds, aromatic substitution reactions. Right now, all we know about aromatic compounds is that it's a six-membered ring with alternating double bonds in the six-membered ring. So you have three alternating double bonds, a benzene ring. To us, that's what aromatic has meant. But aromatic is so much more and so fascinating. And so what makes an aromatic molecule? That's what we get into there. Reactions of those aromatics. And then we start getting into some fun stuff because we get into the aldehydes, the ketones, the carboxylic acids, their derivatives, enols, enolates, amines, carbohydrates. We start getting into the biological chemistry. And in this section from sort of chapter 20 on is what I think of, it's not quite the biological chapters, but it is chemistry that is biological chemistry. And so this is the chemistry that governs all of those things, such as carbohydrates and proteins and DNA and all of that stuff and the biology, the chemistry of life. That's where we really start getting into that. And much more, much greater synthetic challenges because we're pulling from everything that we did before in the synthesis in those. So why do we learn about all of these different functional groups and the chemistry of them? We oftentimes think of them as just relevant to the chapter that we're in and the reactions of those molecules. But I like to think of it more as developing a toolbox that each chapter that we go through, we get more and more tools and we get a bigger tool chest and bigger types of tools that we can use to design and build molecules to do synthesis. And that is part of what organic chemistry is. There are many, many, many facets of organic chemistry, but part of it is learning to be able to synthesize molecules, to be a synthetic organic chemist, and to take each one of these tools and to build a target molecule. And so part of what we do through this is iteratively or stepwise learn how to deal with bigger synthetic challenges. How do we take a target molecule and work backwards into breaking it down and figuring out how to build it from smaller components. And along the lines, we will find that some things that take us 3 and 4 steps right now, when we get into the aldehydes and ketones chapter, we can do in one step. We find better tools, tools that allow us to be able to do things faster than we could before. So I think of them as tools, essentially, that we're learning in how to do a bigger job. Okay. So in terms of that syllabus, the assessment, the way that I typically do assessment is that homework, I think of as indispensable practice that you do kind of on your own, that doesn't need a whole lot of input from me. Every book, every problem in the textbook is a good problem. Every problem in that OChem as a second language is a good problem. And when you run out of problems, you ask me and I give you more problems. I will find more study sets and more targeted study guides for you to use. In addition to that, I then put up cooperatives. The cooperatives are after you've done that homework sort of sets. The cooperatives are things that I grade that are challenge problems, essentially, that you can't solve them in just 5 minutes or 10 minutes and sitting down and looking at them. They take a lot of discussion between groups. They take a lot of interaction and thinking about, and sometimes even visits to office hours to try to figure out these cooperatives. They're much greater in detail. They're much more challenging. And this is what I tend to grade you on, are the co-ops more than the homework. I don't really give grades for homework. And in fact, the way that it's always worked is that I've never given a grade for homework. And people in the physics department and other areas, we always get together during flex week and we talk about all these things that we do in our classes. And people are always saying, how do you get your students to do the homework? How do you get them to study? And I say, I don't, I just give them homework and I don't even grade it. And they say, you don't grade it, why do they do it? I said, because they fail if they don't do it. It's like OChem. They know what they need to do, they're on it, they just do it. I don't even have to say, all I have to say is this is important and you guys go and do it. And it's amazing. And they're like, yeah, that doesn't work for us. And so then I have to explain that OChem students are different. Actually, what winds up happening is they explain to me that OChem students are different. OChem students, we have in this thing, I'll just let you in on this now. We have this thing within education that instructors refer to a student who does everything that you want them to do, that straight A sort of perfect student who is on the ball and always on it and comes to office hours and has all those questions. We call those our unicorns. They're the mythical student that everybody wants and nobody gets. And OChem is a class full of unicorns. You guys are my unicorns. You guys are the ones who you have weathered Chem 1A. You have weathered the math classes. You've weathered Chem 1B. You survived Chem 1B. You might be scarred, but you survived Chem 1B. You've now survived Chem 12A. You're at the top of the college in terms of the types of materials that you're dealing with. You all know how you learn and what you need to do to be successful. You are the unicorn students. And so I treat you like that. I treat you like adults. And I'll tell you what you need to do. And then you guys by and large go and do it and make it happen. And that's the way we make it work. So the cooperatives are what I look at. Those are the challenge problems. And I generally put those up and tell you when it's time to start a cooperative. I'll put an assignment up on Canvas that says, hey, it's time to start this co-op and here it is. And they're all up. You can see them all right now. If we back up and we go over to the cooperatives, I've got some of them up here. I've got one for the alkynes. I've got the nuclear magnetic resonance. I've got FTIR for mass spec. I've got the paracyclic reactions co-ops already up there. And you can take a look at what's involved in those. And these are mostly synthesis ones for the alkynes. So there are problem sets that are here that are ready to go. I wouldn't suggest starting on those just yet. I would say, let's wait until we get through the material that we want to get through so that we can understand those before we jump into those. And then I sort of tell you when I think it's time, when I think you're ready to start those. And if you want to start them ahead of time, That's fine. They're there. They're there for you. Okay. And then beyond the cooperatives, back to that syllabus. Beyond the cooperatives, we have the quizzes and exams. I have, I think, 10 quizzes. Each one is a 20-point quiz. And I have some fairly harsh words in here, like, there will be no makeup quizzes. I should just take that out because that doesn't really exist. There's lots of flexibility. Exams, I have scheduled three exams. Well, two exams and a final, two midterms and a final is the way that I've got. But the exams are all equal weight. I don't weight the final any more than I weight any of the other exams. So it's just three exams at 100 points. So you got 10 quizzes, that's 38%. You got five-ish co-ops, which come out to be about 66%. And then you got the three exams, 56%, 530 points, all points equal basis. And it's just straight percentage from there. Okay, so the grading is fairly simple. In terms of, where do I have it? Schedule. The quizzes are laid out in the week. So normally this would be on that day, but instead I'm going to have the quiz open over a period during the week. So you have a couple of days to be able to complete the quiz. So we'll have a quiz most weeks, except for in the week where we have an exam. So I'll have one quiz a week and then an exam in week five. That exam will cover whatever material we've gotten to up until that point. The one thing that I like to try to do though is I like to try to make a pretty clean break between exam one, which is chapters 10, 11, 12, 13, and some of 14 that fits in there with ethers, epoxides, and thiols, and the spectroscopy. I like the spectroscopy to be its own exam so that you're not doing different types of content on the same exam. So I like it to be that exam two is pretty much our spectroscopy exam. That'll happen after spring break, giving you time to practice because you really need some substantial practice with these types of spectroscopy things. It's an entirely different skill set than the chemistry that we were doing before. So we like to give you enough time to be able to practice that. And then we get back into this chemistry here, and the final exam is generally cumulative over the semester, 50% of that being the new stuff and 50% of that being some of the older material that gets thrown in there. But I don't know if Zaruba talked to you about something called the American Chemical Society standardized exam. Did he ever mention that? Okay, generally, we like to give the American Chemical Society standardized exam as an exit exam. We usually use that as the final. So typically what I have is a third exam in this last week and then the ACS exam in week 17 during finals week. The ACS exam, because of its format, cannot be given in an open sort of format because they worry about the questions getting out onto the web. And so the last couple of semesters that we've done this online, I haven't used the ACS exam. So we can just like take that stress away and not have to worry about that. Usually I use it as an exit exam because it's a check on the teaching. The curriculum that I've designed is very different than a traditional organic chemistry class, or at least somewhat different. And the testing style that I use is very different. I tend not to use multiple choice questions. I hate multiple choice questions. I tend to have more essay type questions. Even when I do it in a Canvas format, I still do it in an essay style format more than I do a multiple choice format. And yet the ACS exam is all multiple choice. And so it's a very different testing style and skill. Despite that, what I have found over the 20 years that I've been teaching organic chemistry is that students out of my curriculum perform extraordinarily well on the ACS exam. We usually beat the national average by a couple of points, even not teaching all of the material that is on the ACS exam. So the ACS exam covers all of the biological components that you would cover in the textbook as well. That's an additional like four chapters that we don't even talk about or touch. And despite that information being on that exam, we still beat the national average by a couple of points. So I have faith in the teaching, in that we're doing good work here. And And it bums me out that we're not doing it, but it's okay. We'll survive. All right. Any questions coming up for people so far in terms of content here?
I have a question.
Yeah.
About the quizzes. Are those going to be uploaded online or are they through the Canvas format?
So Abby, what I'll do is I'll put them on Canvas. And generally what I do is the quizzes are not a Canvas quiz per se. It's not that you will be doing multiple choice on Canvas or even entering answers on Canvas. What I typically do is just have the submission open on Canvas. So the quiz is posted there. You download the quiz, you do your work, however it is you want to do it on paper or on a whiteboard or whatever it is you want to do that work on. You snap photographs of it and try to turn those into a PDF if you can. PDFs are much, much preferred. And then you upload those PDFs in the Canvas shell and then I access them and grade them from there. And typically what I do is I take and I download them all at the same time onto my iPad and then I annotate them on the iPad and then I upload them and give you the annotated version so that you can see all my comments in terms of your answers, okay? And same thing for the exams. That's the exact same way that I do the exams, okay? Any other questions come up? Oh, you guys are easy today. You're making it easy on me. All right. The schedule is a little aggressive. What I say is that I hold the quizzes and the exams pretty much on the dates where I've set them, or at least I open them within the weeks where I've set them. However, depending upon how fast the class goes, I tend to progress only as fast as the class will allow me to go, trying to keep everybody on board. That means that sometimes certain subjects take longer. Sometimes certain subjects can progress faster. We just have to wait and see how you guys are and how you guys handle the content. And so the schedule is subject to change in how long each subject takes us. And this is just sort of a tentative schedule in the way that I think about it. And from there, we kind of go at the pace that the class is able to go at, okay? What else do I have in here? Okay, I've shown you the schedule, I've shown you the syllabus. What's in additional resources? There's some nomenclature stuff if you're looking for the actual nomenclature resources. There's a nucleophilic substitution and an elimination guidelines that I use for SN1, SN2, E1, and E2. So this is a document that when I'm teaching this section in Chem 12A is extremely helpful for students to figure out relative nucleophilicity, nucleophilicity values up against pKa, different types of solvents which promote SN2 and E2 versus solvents that promote ionization in SN1 and E1. I don't know if Zaruba gave you this or something equivalent he may have. Ways of evaluating whether a reaction will go SN1, SN2, E1, or E2. So those are sort of my guidelines that are there. And then here, what we have is more for spectroscopy. These are websites that have spectroscopy problems, both NMR and mass spec, that I have found to be extremely helpful because the book does not give sufficient practice in the spectroscopy sections. And so when you're looking for more spectroscopy type of work to do, when we start going over these problems, I'm going to direct you to this area and these resources. That these are all NMR problems that allow you to be able to zoom in and to be able to see the spectra and work towards figuring out what the solution is. And so I have that for mass spec as well, and a tutorial for mass spec that shows you those types of spectra and allows you to be able to work through in sort of a multiple choice fashion, being able to work through and figure out what a spectrum represents. So these are outstanding resources that I've found online that I tend to place here. And then the Zoom recordings, I'll just show you from fall. What I typically do is I typically put in a description of what we covered that day, along with the date of the lecture. And then I typically put up the audio only file so that people can listen to it if they want to listen to it like a podcast. I put up the video with the audio so that you can watch the video in real time. And then I put up lecture notes. So those are my PDF lecture notes that I take. If I grab onto one of these someplace, you can see sort of in the Alkenes. And these are notes that I make in Notability. Notability is my sort of go-to app for doing live lecture notes. And these will be done in real time in the video. I don't tend to have them pre-done as slides. And so Notability is just, I'm in love with it. It's a fantastic application. And I've been using it for a number of years now because as my girls went to college and helping both of them sort of long distance education wise, I found Notability and that was what I was using. And it just was an easy translation into this sort of online format and being able to use it in a projection mode over Zoom. So you'll be able, those are the, these are the lectures from fall 2020. The new ones, today's lecture will go there when we're done with it. And I'll usually get them uploaded at the end of the day, depending upon how much time it takes me to edit a video. If I need to go in and edit a few things out, or if there's some glitches or something, then it takes me a little bit longer, but usually I can get them put up right after my last class in that evening, sort of in the 5 to 6 zone, I'll get them up online. Okay. Worst case scenario, they would go up the next morning. Worst case scenario. Laboratory resources, I'll talk more about that in the afternoon lab. I already did that for this morning's lab, but in the afternoon lab, I'll do a repeat of that and go over it. And while I'm here, I might as well explain why we have two lab sections and the availability to go into either lab section. The lab sections were designed because of the physical restriction of having 20, 21 students in a lab at a time being able to work as a maximum sort of that we can handle within the lab. Beyond that, we split them into lab sections so that there's sufficient room for everybody to be able to work. When we translated that to Zoom, it translated into a workload issue for an instructor. And so we still have a 21, 22 student cap on the lab. And because we're offering the two lab sections, it makes sense to offer them at different times and give people flexibility. And so while I could just do it all in one and record it and make everybody else watch the recording, I thought I'm getting paid, I might as well work. And it gives me more face time with you guys. And so we'll have two lab sessions and that'll just allow people to avoid conflicts. So you can attend either one throughout the day. There'll be the same information morning and afternoon that's presented. It'll just be a second opportunity. And I'm going to utilize some of that lab time for lecture discussion, meaning review of lecture topics, giving you sort of an extended office hours ability to come in and do a problem solving session. You guys come in with whatever questions you want, and we'll use that 2 hour lab period to sit down and break it down and do whatever it is you guys want help with. So we'll have like every third lab session is programmed out as a study session for the lecture, just stealing a little bit of time from lab as makes sense in this online format. Because in reality, one of the things that you're missing that makes STEM and particularly organic chemistry work is working together. And in COVID, we just can't do that. It's just so hard. And so I think creating as many formats as we can to get people together and allow discussion and communication, and we can even set up some breakout rooms within those discussion sections if you want to be able to go and do some work and then come back and address some of the problems that you ran into all together. We might use some different tools in order to allow you guys some chances to be able to communicate and work together and get to know each other a little bit better, because that's what really makes this work. Okay, JC, are the labs going to be like Zorubas where it is mostly theory-based, or do we have virtual lab simulations? A virtual lab simulation where you're clicking on things and doing things is a very hard thing to simulate. And when I have looked online, there are a couple of resources that are doing simulations now, and they all suck. They are all horrid. They leave you just trying to figure out what can you actually click on and what can you not. It's more like a video game, trying to figure out how do I do this more than what is the skill that I'm actually trying to learn. So yeah, they're going to be mostly theory-based. However, I invested in this, which I don't know how to use very well yet. This is a gimbal for an iPhone. So it's my iPhone gimbal and the fuzzy dead cat microphone attached to the gimbal. And I'm going to go and I'm going to try to film the lab starting tomorrow. And we're going to see what I can do. It's either going to be horrible or it will be marginally okay until it starts to get better and I figure out how to use this. But it'll be an iterative process and you guys can critique my filmmaking. What I plan to do is not try to film like 3 hours of lab. I try to plan on filming the lab and then editing it down to maybe like a 20-minute segment of explaining both how I'm doing things and why I'm doing things, but not have you sit there watching a reaction that's cooking up for, you know, 30 minutes and just watching the dryer spin, because that doesn't make any sense. So we'll see how that goes. The idea is that I will present the theory as a lecture the first day. I will upload a video to Canvas that is the actual lab that is being done. You guys watch the video on your own time. The next class that we get together, we do another discussion section talking about the data that was taken and the things that we saw in the video that gives you a chance to ask questions and to talk about what I want in terms of data analysis and write-up. And then you guys produce a written lab report that gets uploaded into Canvas. And yeah, I agree, Labster was a horrible experience and I never want to see it again. Yes. Thanks for that, Cole. Any other questions? So that's my idea for lab. That's what I have in mind in that regard. And hopefully that's going to pan out.
This isn't about lab, but it's a lecture resource question. Yeah. I saw in the syllabus something about SIs, but do you have an SI for this class?
I'm still trying to identify somebody to do SI. So it's hard given this format that we've done it in for to rope somebody into doing SI. So I have some feelers out trying to rope somebody in and I'm hoping for that. And in absence of that, I'll just have to open up more office hours and we'll use more lab time. I don't know, we'll figure out something in order to accommodate. If SI does not happen, we'll find a good workaround for that. You know, one of the things that SI is really good for is that it gives you a peer that you are not so intimidated by to ask the really small questions. I think there gets to be anxiety over asking certain questions and sometimes that peer tutor can really alleviate that anxiety and help you and work with you to answer even those small things. And what I would encourage you is to ask those small questions of me as well, that there is absolutely no judgment. We are all learning. And, you know, you didn't come into this as an expert in organic chemistry. And I don't even, you know, sometimes it takes a while to work out what the question is. And I understand that because you're learning. And so trying to figure out how to even phrase the question, sometimes I can really help you with that because I've been doing it for 20 years. You start off and the question, you're having trouble even phrasing it. And I'm like, I got it. All right, let's do it. We're in and we're rolling. So please try not to be, I had one student one time who came into office hours and as much as I try to encourage people to come into office hours, she pushed the chair back against the wall as far as she could get it. And she brought her legs up in the chair and was as far away from me in the office as she could possibly get. And I said, I'm really not that scary. And she says, that remains to be seen. And By the end, she was coming into office hours all the time. And it was like, it was her office too. She would just kind of come in and take over. And so I promise I'm really not that scary. I'm really pretty accessible. And I encourage you to reach out to me with questions anytime. Okay. Be it on email, during lecture, in office hours, I'm pretty available and I'm pretty quick on email. And I use, you know, you may think that it's difficult to communicate over email to answer some of these questions. It's really not. I tend to write a lot on Notability and be able to answer questions, even mechanistic questions, very easily through email, and to be able to send you that Notability file that comes over as a PDF and opens immediately as an image in your email. And so we communicate in drawings more than we communicate in words. Do I prefer Professor Camera or Jason? I typically prefer Jason. I will answer to anything, including, hey, you. But yeah, Jason is the preferred. I don't get too caught up in titles. That's, you know, that's more of an East Coast thing where we get caught up in titles and being referred to as doctor or professor. And if it helps with the accessibility component, my name is Jason. And I answer to that. Okay. Thanks, JC. Okay. Any other questions before we maybe in the last half hour that we've got here, jump in and start looking at alkynes?
I had kind of a specific question. I live in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So if the power goes out, which it probably will.
Yeah.
Is there anything specific that we should do? Just read alkynes in the book and do the practice problems?
Correct, BB. Yes, that's exactly it. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to start lecturing on that material. A good progression, really, is to, before the lecture, to take a look at the book and to read through the book. The book is accessible. The book is well written. And the book is written in, if I were going to write an organic chemistry book, it would be this book. That's my teaching style. And I like the way that this book is written and I like the problem style that is in this book. So this is a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. I would read those chapters or read that section before the lecture so that you have some idea of where we're going. Sit through the lecture and then maybe even think about rewriting your notes after lecture to process that information a third time, and then start tackling the problems in the back of the book is sort of a progression that I would think of, right? And then beyond that, once we get through the material and I've gone through the material, then I open up the co-op and say, you're ready to start the co-op now, and then start those challenge problems. And if you're struggling with the challenge problems, then that's a good time to either revisit the problems in the book, or maybe you didn't do them to begin with because that's your initial sort of practice, or to start coming into office hours and start hitting me with questions and trying to deal with those co-ops. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. If there's no further questions, let me stop this screen share and start a different one. Okay, so now the one thing that I like to do, there we go, is move. I'm working with multiple monitors. So if you see me looking off to the side a lot, it's because I'm looking over at you guys to see how everything is looking and going and checking the chat periodically. And that's on my second monitor. It's over off to my right. And let's see where we want to start with alkynes. So if we're starting off with alkynes, structure-wise, you know, we're dealing with carbon-carbon triple bonds and something which is sp hybridized. So it's good to think about the different hybridizations and what hybridization really means. And because I'm new with you guys, I don't want to make assumptions just yet in the way that Tsuruba taught. And I want to, and one of my teaching philosophies, I'm going to get used to it, and I'll stop talking about it once I get through it a little bit. One of my teaching philosophies is to constantly remind you of what you know and how it relates to what you're learning that is new, so that the new thing has some foundation on which to base it, so that things are not just always new. they link and harken back to all of these things that we've done already. So it's important to remember where we came from and what we learned about. So when we look at hybridizations, you know, one of the things that's important is to be able to remember that something that is SP3 is tetrahedral, SP2, which is trigonal planar, and SP, which is linear. And we're following through on those centers there. But more than that, these hybridizations, when we look at these hybridizations, they have a hybrid orbital that has a different shape. So when we look at the hybrids are different in their length, in the way that that hybrid orbital is formed. And so if we work from the node and we look at the length, this is an SP3 hybrid and an SP2 hybrid and an SP hybrid. And that orbital size implies a couple of things that are important to think about. Number one is the length of the bond. So that when we look at the length of a bond, if we look at a sigma bond that is between two carbons that are both SP3, the way in which that bond is made is to take that SP3 hybrid and to overlap those two hybrids in order to make a bonding orbital, where the bond is made by the constructive interference or overlap of the two SP3 hybrid orbitals. That makes a bond, which is a carbon-carbon single bond that is long. Well, when we look at a carbon-carbon triple bond, the carbon-carbon triple bond is made of an SP3 hybrid bonding to an SP3 hybrid. And in order to get that overlap, the two carbons, it's not SP3, it's SP hybrid overlap. The two carbons have to get physically closer in order to make that bond. And that makes that bond short. So it's not the pi bonds that are necessarily making the triple bond short. It's actually the sigma bond and the SP hybrid nature of the carbon that means that the two carbons need to get closer because that orbital is short. It makes for a shorter bond. And that's where that bond length difference comes from. So we're looking at something which is like close to 1.3 angstroms or 1.4 angstroms here for a carbon-carbon single bond, but we're closer to 1.1 angstrom in a carbon-carbon triple bond. So that's one aspect, is that the alkyne bond is shorter. But there's another aspect here as well, that when we look at the electron density that's in this, the electron density is held more closely to the nucleus in an SP orbital than in an SP3 orbital. And what that means is that the electron withdrawing capability of the atom has changed based on its hybridization. And that's pretty cool and pretty astounding. So when we take a look at carbon, CH, OH, not NH first, then OH, and then FH, and we look at the pKa values of these different protons, a proton on a carbon, on a nitrogen, on a hydrogen, on a fluorine. The pKa here is a pKa, which is around 60. A proton that is on a nitrogen, its pKa is 45-ish, 45 to 47. Oxygen is 15 to 17. Let's call it 15.7 because that's what water is. And then the fluorine is right around 1 in terms of the pKa. And so when we talk about pKa, we're talking about the acidity constant and the minus the log of that acidity constant. So you remember the Ka values and then how to get a pKa value, you take minus the log of the Ka, and the Ka is the equilibrium constant. And so what we're looking at is we're looking at how stable a carbon with a negative charge on it is versus how stable a nitrogen with a negative charge, or an oxygen with a negative charge, or a fluorine with a negative charge. And that what we find is that these guys going down the line with the negative charges are more stable with the negative, because it is increasing electronegativity as we go across the periodic table from left to right, from carbon to nitrogen to oxygen to fluorine. We're going in increasing electronegativity. And that increasing electronegativity means that as an element becomes more electronegative, it more strongly holds or pulls electrons. And therefore, if fluoride is the most stable with the negative charge, then the F with the proton on it, this proton is going to be the most acidic because it is going to the more stable conjugate. Does that make sense? You guys remember that sort of conversation in Chem 12A? Okay. As we take this and we correlate this to a carbon which is tetrahedral that may have a proton on it versus a carbon which is an sp2 hybridized carbon with a proton on it versus a carbon which is sp hybridized with a proton on it, these are increasing in terms of their electronegativity, because they are sp3, sp2, and sp hybridized. And that means that we're looking at a carbanion, or a series of carbanions here, where, and we could do it this way, this is even more thoughtful, I guess, is that the negative charge resides in an sp3 hybrid. On the sp2 carbon, the negative charge resides in an sp2 hybrid. And in an sp hybridized carbon, it resides in that squat narrow sp hybrid. And so what we're finding is that the electron density is held more tightly to the carbon as we move from sp3 to sp2 to sp. And that is essentially what electronegativity is. And that means that inherently, this is increasing electronegativity. And that means that this is most stable. And that means that this guy down here is most acidic. So thinking about these trends that we already learned, that were periodic trends through carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine going across a row in a periodic table, can be translated into the same thing with hybridization for the same element, carbon, which means that not all carbons have the same inherent electronegativity, that carbons have different electronegativity depending upon what their hybridization is, and that the pKa of these protons changes. So the pKa, when we look at it, pKa here is 60-ish. For a proton on a double bond like this, it usually winds up sort of in the 47 range, and on an alkyne, usually around the 24 to 22 range. Let's call it 22 in terms of its pKa, which means that they correlate pretty amazingly with nitrogen at 45, double bond at 47, oxygen at 15, alkyne at 22. What that means is that I can think about these changes in hybridization, that an sp2 hybridized carbon is sort of equivalent in electronegativity to a nitrogen, and that an sp3 hybridized carbon is very similar in electronegativity to an oxygen. not quite, oxygen's more electronegative, but on par, pretty darn close. And so that gives me a framework to be able to think about the acidity of these compounds going forward, because the biggest thing with alkynes as we move forward with alkynes is what we can do with the acidity of an alkyne. Okay, so there's two things there that I wanna hit. I wanna hit structure and I wanna hit acidity. And I wanna do just a little bit more structure before I do the acidity. So when we look at the structure of an alkyne, it's kind of important to realize that when we look at the alkyne, that that there are two pi bonds in the alkyne. And I don't know if Zaruba has shown you images of this. I'm sure you've seen images in the textbook of this. But what we typically do is we typically have the pi orbital. That's not my best pi orbital. And these pi orbitals overlap in order to be able to give the pi bond. So this one would be in plane, if I'm thinking about the plane of the board, like that. But then the second pi bond extends orthogonally to this. And this gets kind of ugly in drawing it. But this one extends with an angle which is essentially 90 degrees to the first. And so if I go from here down to here, I'm at a 90 degree angle in terms of where those planes are and where those pi bonds are. And the sigma bond is in between the two carbons. So it's important to know that when we look at an alkyne, that an alkyne is related to an alkene in that the electron density is above and below the plane. And so when we look at it, what we see is we typically see an orbital that resides above and an orbital that resides below. And these are occupied orbitals. So they use the colors of red and blue to demonstrate that they are occupied. And that's one pi bond. And then the second pi bond is an orbital that sits in front of this and an orbital that sits behind it, which is a little bit harder to draw. And so the second pi bond fits here and behind. And if we were to see them both at the same time, we would see this CC bond sort of sitting in the middle of these four lobes, alternating red and blue. One pi bond in plane and one pi bond orthogonal to it. Okay, so that's important to keep in mind because of how the pi bonds react. That remember that when we take a double bond and we take a double bond and we react it with, let's choose HCl, it's the easiest way to do. And we're gonna protonate this. Why does this react and give a product? And yet, if I take a molecule that has a unit of unsaturation in it, like a five-membered ring, and I react it with HCl, there's no reaction. And what is the reaction that actually happens? Well, what happens is that pi bond that extends in this plane, the proton here, that is acting as a strong electrophile that has a partial positive charge, and the partial minus that is the electron density that is here, this electron density is reaching out and grabbing that proton because of the pi bond's accessibility outside of the atoms of the molecule. And it is that outside bond that allows it to react, and I wanted to do something that was units of unsaturation, but I could do it this way just as easily. I could say, why can't this alkane react? And it's because the sigma bond resides in the plane in between the two carbons. And because it's in between the two carbons, it's not accessible. And so the HCl can't protonate it. There's just no accessibility there. There's too much sterics in and around from the other substituents that are attached to that carbon. Alkynes react exactly the same way as alkenes do. Oh, I didn't finish this out. This goes, of course, to the H adding and the chloride adding. And I don't have any difference here in my different groups to tell us which way it's going to go. It's just going to add across the double bond, and it will pass through the carbocation, and then the chloride will add to the carbocation. And so I'm not showing mechanistically why. I just really wanted to talk about the reason that it reacts, and because of its position outside, away from the other parts of the molecule, that allows it to be accessible by the HCl. Alkynes have that same accessibility, and the position of the orbitals is important because of the reactivity that we're going to see with the alkynes in the way that they react. Okay, so we'll hold that for a second. Check the time, I got a few minutes. And let's do acidity.
Quick question. So the bond or the carbon that the Cl attaches to, is that orbital positively charged?
So no.
Or partially positive.
Let's do it this way. I'll do it down here in a little bit smaller to fit in with what I've got. When I have a double bond, let's just do something that is asymmetric, that has two hydrogens on it as a reminder, so that we can remember mechanism. And we take HCl, and the double bond reaches out, grabs the proton, kicks electrons back to the chloride. We get what is called the Markovnikov addition, where the proton, that is this proton here, adds to the side that has more protons. The rich gets richer is the way that we say it. That produces a carbocation that is a tertiary, in this case, carbocation, the more stable carbocation. The reactivity is governed by going through the more stable carbocation. And then the chloride, in a second step, in a stepwise reaction, adds to that carbocation to then finish off the reaction. And so we would get the chloride out here. This then goes from trigonal planar to tetrahedral. And this one is, of course, tetrahedral as well, with the three things on it. So it's not adding to an orbital that is positively charged, but more so a carbocation that resulted from the addition of the proton to the alkene.
Does that help? Yeah, it does.
Cool. Okay, so acidity. When we take a look at alkynes, one of the things that we can do with them is we can deprotonate them. And we need a fairly strong base to do this. And the base of choice that we typically use with alkynes is an amide base, sodium amide. And we typically do this reaction in liquid ammonia. The reason that we do it in liquid ammonia, and that's at minus 33 degrees Celsius, is because of the way that sodium amide is formed. Sodium amide is formed through the reaction of sodium metal with ammonia. When you take sodium metal in its ground state and you put it into ammonia, what it does is it goes through a free radical reaction where the sodium becomes a cation, the ammonia becomes an anion, and we liberate H2 as a gas that comes off of the reaction. And so sodium amide is made by dissolving sodium metal into liquid ammonia. And liquid ammonia, when you put it into a Dewar and you let it evaporate and equilibrate, it auto cools itself down to minus 33 degrees Celsius. That's the boiling point of liquid ammonia. And so that temperature of minus 33 is because that's the boiling point of liquid ammonia, and that's how it just auto cools itself down in what is called evaporative cooling. And so these reactions are always run at that temperature. The pKa on ammonia is right around 45. And so we use pKa instead of pKb because it's convenient. We could write down pKbs and we could talk about the pKb of what amide is, but that just gives us one more thing to have to talk about and think about. It's easier oftentimes to work from the pKa of the ammonia itself. And when we look at the pKa of the acetylene, this is a pKa that is right around 22. And so the amide is a orders of magnitude stronger base than the resulting acetylide anion that gets created. And we make NH3, which can go off as a gas with a small amount of heat that gets created in the process. So we choose the amide base because it is a base that is strong enough to deprotonate the proton on an alkyne. So that's how we do it. If you were to try to use a base like hydroxide, what would happen? Well, when we look at the reaction here and taking sodium hydroxide, one has to remember that hydroxide, you know, the pKa here is 22, but the pKa on water, the conjugate acid, this pKa is 15.7. And so what we find is that this is an equilibrium that winds up happening where the equilibrium is far to the right-hand side. And so we make a tiny bit of this guy and water. I'll leave that there. But the majority of this equilibrium, and the way that I like to think about it, is that the majority of the equilibrium lies on that side, and you get like a minuscule amount on the product side. And so sodium hydroxide is just not a strong enough base to deprotonate an alkyne. All right, so we use these amide bases. There's a couple of different amide bases that we use, two that I like to draw attention to. So the two most prominent bases, strong amine bases. First one is sodium amide, NH2. The second one is lithium diisopropyl amide. So this is drawn this way, lithium N diisopropyl. So this one is sodium amide, and this one is lithium diisopropyl amide, also referred to as LDA. And these are the two strong bases that we use to do these types of jobs. Small base and bulky base. Remember where we use small base and bulky base, or where those came into play? Remember in the SN2, E2, SN1, E1 chapter where we had different types of bases to deprotonate different protons to do different jobs. Bulky bases that went for less sterically hindered protons and small bases that went for more sterically hindered protons. So that's kind of where this comes in. Okay, so why are we talking about alkynyl anions? This is the last thing I'll say real quick, because alkynyl anions give us a form of carbon nucleophile. it's the first time we've seen a carbon nucleophile. We haven't had a carbon nucleophile before. So out of all the jobs that we've done so far in organic chemistry, you haven't made a carbon-carbon bond because you've never had a carbon nucleophile. This carbon nucleophile allows for the making of carbon-carbon bonds. And that means that we can do a whole host of new jobs. It opens up the doors to all kinds of new reactions using alkynyl anions as carbon nucleophiles to make carbon-carbon bonds. And that's where we'll pick it up next time. We'll leave it there. Okay, how are you guys doing? Did we take some of the jitters out of today? We're doing all right. Remains to be seen. Still backed up in the corner with your legs up in the chair. We'll just have to wait and see. It'll be okay. All right, so the afternoon lab starts at 3 o'clock. It probably will not go to 5. It'll go, I don't know, like 3 to maybe 4, 4:30. We'll see how long it takes. And we'll pick it up with there. So you guys know what you need to do. You should go read that chapter on alkynes, get a little bit more familiar with that. Start on some of those homework problems on the alkynes. We'll pick it up and I'll go through the reactions of the alkynes this next class on Thursday. Can I scroll up to the sodium hydroxide reaction? Yes. Remember, I also post all the notes online. So the notes go up as well. So everything will be there for you. So if you miss something, don't panic. It goes up online. Okay. All right. Anybody who has any questions, you're welcome to stay on. I'll stay on for a little bit. Anybody who wants to leave, you're welcome to go. And Dylan is throwing out his phone number there if anybody wants to exchange contact information. That's also a good thing. Another thing that, I should have taken a little time to say that too.
Yeah, maybe that was a little bit forward.
Yeah, it's all right. Don't worry about that. There's a number of different ways to communicate. So let me put it out this way. The OCHEM email link that I put out, ochem@cabrillo.edu, all of you have the ability to send an email to that. And when you send out that email, I believe your email address is attached, but it allows you to communicate out to the class in sort of a non-forward way. Discord is a great one. I love Discord. And I would highly advocate for a Discord channel as well. We had one in the last class and I joined the Discord and I was fairly effective in communicating with students and answering small questions here and there. 11, 12 o'clock at night as I see them pop up on my phone and I'm doing other things. So Discord would be great. And if you do set up a Discord, I'd very much like to be a part of it if you're willing to let me do that. What I was going to say about the email thing too is you can also send out an email to ochem@cabrillo.edu and it doesn't go to me, it goes out to the class. So if you're trying to set up a study group and you're trying to invite students or you're trying to get help with a particular question that you can't figure out, you can always throw it up there at ochem@cabrillo.edu as well. And I think Discord is a fantastic tool. And I saw it used very effectively last class, creating channels for tests, creating channels for quizzes, creating channels for co-ops, creating channels for just discussion or announcements, all of those things. I saw people using them very to great effect. So I would highly recommend if anybody wants to set that up. And if somebody doesn't do it soon, I might jump in and head in to it. We'll see. I've never set one up before, so that would take a learning curve, but I'll figure it out. Okay. If there's any other questions, go ahead and throw them out. And if not, I'll see you guys on Thursday or later this afternoon. I have a quick
question.
Jacy, yes.
Could you kind of reiterate what like that homework thing was? Is it you're going to like suggest kind of a range of problems, or it's like, okay, we know we're working on alkynes, so start working through alkyne problems?
It's more, you know, we're working on alkynes, start working through alkyne problems. So I don't typically, I don't recommend problems in the book and go through the book and pick and choose the good ones. I typically say that everything in the book is good, and as much practice as you can get is important. So I go through the book ones until I exhaust them. And then I move on from there and I move on to the problem sets that I'll put up. and then I'll move on to the co-ops from there onto the challenge problems. So I have a set of synthesis problems that fit with this, but before we get to those synthesis problems, we kind of have to get through some of the chemical reactions of the alkynes first, and then I'll throw those synthesis problems up online for you guys to see.
Gotcha. Okay, thanks.
Okay, but your book problems, those are the first ones to go to.
I know this has probably already been said, so forgive me for repetition's sake, but could you go over the book, the textbook materials? Yeah, Maylee. I hope, sorry if I said your name wrong, just said that in the chat as well.
Yes. So the textbook that we're using is the Klein textbook. Let me see, where is it? It's zoomed all. Okay. I think I have Klein third edition here. The Klein textbook, let me stop the share and I'll share from some different things. The Klein textbook, it's the same textbook that Zaruba had listed for you guys first semester. So there's no change in textbook. That's the textbook for the course that we're continuing using is Klein. Okay. And you can get it, you might even be able to find a PDF of the older second or first edition Klein book online at this point that you might be able to sneak for free. I can't remember where, I don't think I have one, but the electronic digital copies of the textbook are a pretty good deal. And since we're all online anyway, having a digital copy of the textbook isn't so bad. I prefer a paper copy anytime I can get it, but a digital copy is there we go. Cole's got the PDF. If anybody wants one, you can link up with Cole.
So it's not the organic, or it's the organic chemistry one. And then do we also need the organic chemistry as a second language?
No, the second language book is a suggestion. I'm looking to see if I have that on my bookshelf in front of me. And I think all of mine are loaned out.
Okay. And then the study guide is also a suggestion.
Study guide is a suggestion. Yes. The study guide is a debt. Now that's expensive. So the study guide is expensive. It's a suggestion, but it's an expensive suggestion. OChem as a second language is a suggestion the first semester, but it's not going to be super useful as we progress through here because I think it goes through spectroscopy, but it's going to have limited value in the second semester class. It's a cheaper expense. I think for the current version of that book on Amazon sells for $60. Older versions you can probably get for $20. And I would say an older version is just as valuable as the newer version. So I don't think you need to go with the newest and greatest in terms of that book. So those are both suggestions.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody have anything else? I love how everybody hangs on just to wait to see who's going to ask that next question to get everything that I'm absolutely going to get.
Hi. So I have a question just because I know we're going to do like radicals and stuff. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions for like reviewing resources for like looking at like molecular orbital diagrams and stuff and just like tracking electrons and looking at the HOMO and LUMO, because like I thought I kind of got molecular orbital theory and stuff, but it's always whack. And there's also just like a bunch of math too. And I've like followed through like all the partial differential equations and it just gets crazy. So like, I don't know, just some like resources to kind of like look at like the HOMO and the LUMO and just like some stuff to like warm up to tracing electrons through radicals.
When you say tracing electrons through radicals, I know that we're going into the radical chapter. We're still going to deal with orbitals, but the orbitals don't change when you change to radicals. And in fact, free radical chemistry follows very closely with carbocation chemistry. And all of the orbitals are exactly the same. It's just that you're dealing with one electron instead of two. And so from that perspective, there really is no difference in terms of what you need to understand orbital-wise to do free radicals than you did to understand carbocations or carbanions. So what I would say is that for orbitals, there really aren't good resources out there. That when you start getting to orbitals, and you mentioned the quantum mechanics and the differential equations, And there are textbooks. McQuarrie has a great textbook. That is on my textbook someplace. It's molecular orbital theory. And excuse the expression, but it's dry as a popcorn fart. It is a dry reading of math that is hard to access at this level. And really what you need to understand to be successful here is to understand more of what the orbital looks like, its geometry, its location, and its implications for reactivity and how the molecule reacts. And so we can spend a little bit of time and I can show you more, we can review more. It's really about when we say sp3, what an sp3 orbital is, a combination of an s and the 3p orbitals to make 4 hybrid orbitals of a specific size. And the way in which they add together is in linear combinations, that these orbitals are mathematical concepts that can be added as 3-dimensional objects in linear algebra, essentially, in a linear combination.
They take like a linear combination of like the wave functions, solution. Yeah, right. And then they integrate to like find the solutions.
That's right. So understanding that is as much as you really need to understand. Understanding the math, the underlying math behind it, and being able to do it is not so critical for what we need to do. Okay, and then beyond that, understanding the shape and where that shape is located in the molecule, being able to visualize that in the molecule is a very important skill. It's a skill above what most students are able to do, but having that skill allows you to be able to see reactivity within the molecule much better because you're actually looking at the locations of where those electrons are and how accessible they are. And you're mentioning of the HOMO and the LUMO. The HOMO orbital and the LUMO orbital, understanding their geometry and what they look like is also as critical. But figuring out what a HOMO looks like and what a LUMO, the HOMO is a little bit easier because the highest occupied molecular orbital are always your lone pairs, your free radical, or your double bonds, depending upon what your molecule has in it. And your lowest unoccupied molecular orbital is always your electrophilic site. It's always where the largest partial positive is within the molecule. And it is the empty orbital that is that represents that deficiency. And so those are harder to visualize because their shapes are not as pretty. Sometimes they're easy, like a carbocation. The carbocation, the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital is the empty p orbital. And that's pretty easy to visualize, right? But in other molecules, like in a ketone, like say acetone, trying to visualize where that lowest unoccupied molecular orbital is and what it looks like, that's harder. And that takes a lot more practice of looking at molecular orbitals. And that's using something like WebMO and modeling them and visualizing them because there is no easy way to calculate them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's a great question. All right, if there's nothing else, I suggest we adjourn and I'll catch you guys later. Okay, thanks for a great first class. Took all my jitters away. I'm feeling good. All right, take care, you guys.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.